CJAM 99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CJAM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
And welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, Marcia Quinn will be telling us about P2P. So, can you tell me a little bit about P2P?
Sure. Parents to Parent USA was started about 50 years ago by a group of parents in Omaha, Nebraska. One of the parents had a child with Down syndrome and thought it would be great if they could connect with other parents in a similar situation for peer-to-peer support, and we were incorporated in 2006, and we have 37 statewide alliance members, plus DC, who serve all disabilities and diagnosis, special health care needs across the lifespan, and what we do is we train parents who want to be a peer mentor to another parent. And they are trained as a support parent, and then they are matched with newly referred parents to provide resources and social-emotional support.
So I'm guessing, in terms of a new diagnosis, parents who are just starting out, there's some support provided for questions of what are we going to do, how are we going to handle this sort of thing?
Yes, typically the first referral is a new diagnosis, but there are other situational matches that happen. So perhaps somebody is approaching adulthood and they want to explore guardianship, or they want to explore health transition from pediatric care to adult care at 18. Or perhaps they have a new diagnosis. So, for instance, my son has autism, but at 18, both my boys have autism. At 18, one of my sons started epilepsy. So we had a second diagnosis. So we wanted to possibly meet with a parent who is experiencing autism and epilepsy together. So there, it's all based on what the needs are of that family. But yes, typically it is the first diagnosis is when they make the call.
So in your work, do you ever encounter any myths or misperceptions concerning a disability diagnosis?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the internet's a scary place, right? And a lot of diagnoses are a spectrum, like autism, and it can look very different from one person to the next. So there may be assumptions made that a child isn't going to progress based on early intervention or therapies that family might receive. There's a lot of myths. There's a lot of racial and cultural things that occur, and there's a lot of misinformation out there that people are led down a rabbit hole in too much information about what could happen to their child. So I think that it's nice to know if there is a rare genetic disorder or a specific diagnosis, that we can find a person who is experiencing that exact disease or disorder that perhaps they've been informed or have been in the journey a lot longer than that newly diagnosed parent and hopefully can provide some sound information.
What types of disabilities do you most commonly encounter through the organization?
Autism spectrum disorder is number one, just because of the sheer numbers. Intellectual and developmental disabilities is next. Genetic conditions, mental health, and remember this was in the middle of a pandemic, so mental health, this was 2020, and then Down syndrome. So those are our top five.
So in terms of the pandemic, were you able to provide a little bit of mental health relief in the middle of really a global situation there?
Well, definitely. So being a parent of a child with a disability or special health care needs, there already exists a form of isolation. And so you put a pandemic on top of that and people's mental health, they're not able to hold a job because their children are being homeschooled. Well, homeschooling a child with a disability is a little different than a neurotypical child and takes more from the parent. So obviously, they're dealing with isolation, holding a job, fear of their child contracting COVID with the situations that go on in the hospital. And that person, like for instance, my son is nonverbal. So school ended. I was scared that he would contract COVID and be put into a hospital where I couldn't be with him. Definitely the pandemic has added a whole other level of need. And what it's done for parent to parent is we were able to shift our focus to Zoom and online. So our trainings that used to be in person were now via Zoom or modules that they could do on their own time. And that actually, for a lot of parents, that opened up more opportunities because they didn't have to try to get childcare or try to take their child out into a new training facility or a public place that was challenging for their child to be successful in. So in some ways, the pandemic was a trajectory for us to be able to provide more online support. So maybe a support group or a Facebook group, trainings, the one-on-one communication amongst families. We were finding that there was already a trend that people were moving away. This was 2019. We were having discussions that people just weren't attending in-person events. And I don't know if that's generational. And, you know, it's always about meeting the parents where they're at. And a lot of our young parents, they communicate through technology. They communicate through Zoom, texting, emailing versus in-person. So COVID, you know, yes, and we did provide a lot of mental health support because people weren't in school necessarily. Their kids were in school, but they weren't at school. And so they were at home trying to cope with having their child at their, you know, at home all day long while they're trying to hold a job or trying to do their daily activity. You know, getting on a Zoom, I do it every day, but in the beginning, you know, what's the platform? Is it Microsoft Teams? Is it Zoom? Is it, and what are the passwords? And what happens if they don't have the broadband or the Wi-Fi or the computer or the phone?
Or accessible features.
Yeah, exactly. So that's just another layer of stressors and potentially they don't, you know, English isn't their native language and they're trying to navigate these systems and, or possibly they're, you know, their fifth grade education and they navigating the systems of telehealth and online is one thing. And then you add, you know, their child with a disability and getting the therapies or the appointments that they need. So yeah, there's been a lot of challenges, but also opportunities.
So in your time with P2P, has there been any success that stands out for you?
Yeah, a lot actually. I've been here with my co-director. Her name is Lily Brown. And we each are parents of individuals with disabilities or special health care needs, and we job share. I'm in Washington, and she's in Pennsylvania. And over the last 3 years, there's a couple really great things that have happened. We've grown. We've added two new statewide alliance members and are talking with a third right now. So that was one of our strategic plans, was to grow to all 50 states. We're trying to take that slow because it does take a lot of time to onboard a state. And when they are an alliance member, they have to provide matching and services to the entire state for all families. So it's a big undertaking for them to staff and to budget for. So we've grown. We've provided created more of a an online communication platform for our Alliance members to do the matching. So if I'm in Washington, which I'm at, and this P2P isn't able to find a match in my state, there's a whole matching netiquette, an online communication platform for them to go beyond state lines. And that's where the genetic and some of the more rare disorders. And so they can go and say, I'm looking for a parent with this rare genetic disorder who speaks Spanish, and they can make a match across the country if they can't find it in their state. So that's something we've mastered, and there's a whole process that we put together for that. What other great things? Oh, we kicked off a diversity, equity, and inclusion committee. And as part of that, we are doing, since George Floyd, we're doing a racial and social injustice task force, and they talk about Black and African American families with disabilities and some of the inequities that they face. And then we're also launching in September some outreach to other diverse communities, Native tribal communities, fathers. And then we also have another task force for Spanish speaking staff and families. So how do we meet those families where they're at? How do we best provide culturally competent and sensitive materials in their language? How do we support them through support groups? So there's been a lot of different work going on at Parent to Parent USA that we're excited about. But we're always obviously growing and finding out whatever, you know, where the parents are at, meeting their needs.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. In this segment of our show, Kelsey Farrell will be giving us an update on About Face. So, can you tell me a little bit about the latest happenings with About Face?
Yeah, sure. So we have a lot going on right now. I'm doing our summer camp programs. About 100 kids have been able to attend our camp programs this summer. We did a survey earlier this year. So we surveyed a lot of the About Face stakeholders, and we found out some really interesting statistics, such as one-third of people surveyed identified as having a disability, but two-thirds of people did not identify as having a disability. So what that shows us is that a lot of people with facial differences do not identify as having a disability. And this survey was not conducted by About Face. It was conducted for us via a third party. We have a new campaign launching in the fall, and so we're really excited about that. And we're still doing our scholarships. So every year we award 2 scholarships to people with facial differences who are going to attend college or post-secondary. And we have a school program, an educational school program that introduces kids to people with facial differences and a bunch of different kinds of differences. So that's something that we're doing as well. Other than that, I'm sorry.
Quite all right. I was just wondering, how do you go about reaching out to the facial difference community to let them know that your programs and supports still exist?
Yeah, so that's a good question. We use social media a lot for that, to promote our programs. And we also we have newsletters that go out via email. So we do email social media. Yeah.
So, do you do any work in regards to the mental health impact connected with having a facial difference?
We have a peer support for them, where people with facial differences can be matched with a peer, and they can get support that way. And we also have a lot of resources on our website that relate to bullying and mental health things as well. And that's something that we're also focusing more on as well.
So, do you ever encounter any myths or misperceptions about having a facial difference? And if so, how do you go about educating people and sort of clearing those up?
Mm-hmm. So, for me, personally, again, this is a personal take, I definitely have, I have encountered that. And the misconception is most often that, I can't speak for anyone else, but for me, it's, people assume that I have a cognitive disability as well because of, how I look. So that's something that, I get that quite often, actually. And I think the best way to combat that or to educate people is to talk to them and to start that conversation. And so if someone asks or, comments something on social media or in person, I can talk to them and educate them, tell them what Loki's syndrome is, which is the syndrome that I have, and just talking to people, I think, and getting my story out there is commonly the best way to educate.
So, in your time with About Face, has there been any success moment in terms of raising awareness that stands out for you?
Yeah, I just started with About Face last month, so, but I think just the comments that we get from people who attend our camps or different programs, the people who, they say how much About Face has benefited them and how much it has changed their lives, how grateful they are for a support system, just those, those kind of comments are really impactful, and it makes the work that we're doing so important.
So, if you could send any message to the community about the need for continued advocacy and education, what would you tell them?
There's definitely still a need for education. People with facial differences, they face challenges in a lot of most aspects of their lives, and that's based on just society not being aware or educated of facial differences, and people who have a facial difference are people, and they are humans, and everyone deserves the same opportunities and the same opportunities as anyone else, in terms of work, in terms of school, in terms of social interactions. It's just people just need to be more educated, and that will be so much better for everyone.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Mm-hmm.
Handy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
From the War Apps.
Did you know that a second of fun in the wrong place could change your life forever?
My name is Rebecca, and I lost my leg in a boating accident.
Lots of kids in our child amputee program
have their own stories. Now, we help kids to play safe. Take from us, accidents can happen to anyone, anywhere.
Watch the War Amps Play Safe video at waramps.ca. Play safe!
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Marcia Quinn told us a little bit about P2P. Kelsey Farrell told us a little bit about About Face. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Christine O'Brien and Liz Malloy about GACI Global. So if you could both introduce yourselves and tell me a little bit about GACI Global.
Sure, Liz, okay. Can I go first?
I'm from Ireland, and I'm the parent of two children who suffer from a rare disease called GACI, and it's a very high mortality rate, and unfortunately one of my children died from it, so my surviving child then lives with the lifelong complications of it, and there was no support groups when my children were born, and there was very little information, so a group of us kind of, people actually just trying to find each other around the world before Facebook, before all the ways people have of connecting now, and a group of those families got together and created GACI Global, so that's how I'm here.
So. And I'm Christine, I'm from Massachusetts, I have two children who were diagnosed with GACI caused by ENPP1 deficiency. They are fortunate to be both survivors. My son will be 12 tomorrow, and my daughter is 9.5 now. And they both do deal with complications of the disease on a day-to-day basis. And like Liz said, we came together years and years ago when my daughter was just an infant, and that's when we first connected. And over the years, realized that we needed to create something a little bit more official than our online support group, and so GACI Global was born.
So how does GACI typically affect a person?
So there's a wide spectrum. No two people are the same. It can affect even siblings very differently. But typically in infants, when it affects an infant, it's called generalized arterial calcification of infancy, and it causes calcification of their major arteries. It can cause joint calcification. It can cause heart issues, heart failure, strokes, you know, very scary things. And then typically if a baby survives past 6 months of age, they have a pretty good chance of, surviving and growing up and living with this disease for the rest of their lives. And for the older kids and the adults, they deal with something called ARHR2. It's autosomal hypophosphatemic rickets type 2. And so when they're babies, it affects their arteries primarily. And when they're teens or kids, teens and adults, it's more of a bone disease, and it can affect their bones. They're on medication. My kids, at least, are on medication 5 times a day to help their bones be healthy. But there is no cure for it. It's sort of an okay treatment, but it doesn't prevent some of the more serious complications that can develop down the road. My kids are still fairly young, but our teenage and adult patients deal with calcification in their joints that's progressive and painful, and it can restrict movement, mobility, and cause a lot of pain and fatigue.
So, as parents, what sort of coping mechanisms did you use when you realized your children were going to be facing the possibility of living with such a difficult condition?
In the start, you kind of spend a lot of time with appointments because it also affects or can affect the eyes, can cause hearing loss, and it can cause dental problems. So you spend an awful lot of the early time really getting a grip to, you know, all the different specialisms you need to see. And then you'd really try to reach out and find other people you want to hear good. You want to, you know, find out somebody who survived. What did they do? You know, what treatment they had? Did they do something different that you're not doing because you want the same outcome for your child? And then obviously you start thinking, how can I make things better for my child and for everybody else? What can we do to actually, you know, encourage research? And that's really then how we move towards advocating on a wider scale rather than just for our own children.
So, in your time with GACI Global, has there been any success moment in advocacy that stands out?
I'm not sure which one of you will take the... I suppose we have been very fortunate to have some wonderful researchers working with us. I suppose our first big one was when we discovered that the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda were researching the condition, and they had a huge interest in it, and they have done a natural history study, and that was a huge part of the research that's needed when you're trying to develop a treatment. So that was a huge step forward. The doctors there, one doctor in particular, is amazing. He, you know, is responsive to all of our patient queries and our organisation non-profit queries as well for assistance with maybe even, you know, developing literature and information for our community. So that was a big moment when we found them. The next big moment maybe was when we discovered, you know, that somebody was working on a treatment and that our actual input could help move that treatment forward to, you know, clinical trials, and we could have an input into protocols to make it right for our patients. And that those kind of moments have been hugely kind of feel-good moments for feeling something is really working.
I feel like another important sort of piece of the advocacy part of what we do is being able to connect other families, because for so long there was nothing out there and the research was outdated, the articles online were outdated, and so people didn't have the most up-to-date information. But now with our website and our support group, you know, it's at their fingertips. They can connect with a big group of people who are traveling the same road, and we can help connect them with doctors and specialists and researchers, and we can connect them to other families, either in their, you know, local area or virtually in our group. And I just think that connection piece has been huge for so many people.
And when we actually got a number of patients together, and none of them really had ever met anyone else with their condition, some of the adults even in their life, that's very special, kind of to create those connections or be part of creating them.
So do you have any advice to someone out there who might be struggling with a new diagnosis, looking for answers?
Do you mean a new diagnosis, like a GACI diagnosis, or a new rare disease diagnosis in general?
A new GACI diagnosis, wondering if their child's going to have a chance at a real life.
I would recommend they connect with us as soon as possible. And we are there to help connect them with doctors that can answer their questions and families who can offer support and also answer questions as to what worked for them or what didn't work, and, you know, share coping strategies and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
How could my audience go about finding more information about the work you do?
We are on social media. We are on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram. And we have our website. It's www.gaciglobal.org.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank you both for taking the time out to do this. But if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
So, my friends, I'm very grateful for Kelsey's insights on the show today. The fact is, people with facial differences are like any other group within the disability range. You should be seen as a person, not a condition. You look beyond the obvious. You get to know there are some pretty remarkable people. Remarkable not only because they rise to difficult circumstances, but because they choose to do so, living their lives with dignity and strength and wisdom. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.